Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, a little birdie flew into the studio and told me that there is an update.
Well, yes, and another little birdie reminded me that there was a second update.
A second update?
There's an update and an update.
Oh,
well, one was...
I only saw one birdie.
Oh, well, you were the other birdie. You reminded me about that we talked about the serial killer there, the classified ad killer, and he did get executed on that day in question.
He did.
So he's gone.
He was...
End of story. But the main update, the one that I had before you reminded me about that our guy we talked about got killed, was about that Scott Peterson, the one that was the deputy that failed to act at the Parkland shootings and stayed outside, and we went over that security guards and police officers have no duty to protect you.
Right.
That they are not bound by the law. However, yesterday he was arrested. And they said that he appeared in court on Wednesday on 11 charges, including negligence and child neglect, for not entering the building during the rampage last year. In court papers, prosecutors said 5 people were killed and 4 others wounded after Peterson took up his position, gun drawn, but did not go inside. President Trump and others have branded Peterson a coward, but can Broward County prosecutors prove his hesitation to act amounts to a crime? So he would be the coward of Broward County. That's how he would be described from here on out. Legal experts are not so sure and suggested prosecutors may have overreached. This is a unique prosecution pushing the bounds of criminal liability, a prominent defense attorney said. He was not involved in the case, though. While elected prosecutors many times bow to the court of public opinion, our justice system demands that a case like this be tested in a court of law. Legally, this is a tough one for the prosecution. So the one guy agreed, and he said, although as a father, legislator, and human being, I believe that there is no societal defense to cowardice, the law has consistently and recently held that there is no constitutional duty for police to protect us from harm. So
he speaks the truth.
Yeah, so there you go. But that didn't matter. They charged him anyway. They put his bond for bail at $402,000.
Sounds like a lot of politicians down there trying to get some notoriety in the paper.
Yeah, I was really surprised that they did that. But, I mean... I don't know if legally they can prove that he did anything wrong, but morally, he deserves to be arrested.
That sounds like excessive bail or bond, because basically what the bond is for is a surety to make sure he appears in court. I mean, do you think this guy probably lived there his whole life and his whole family is there and everything like that? Do you think he's really a flight risk? Probably not.
Well, probably not, but maybe just being in prison, if he's in prison awaiting trial, that might be all the retribution that you need.
It could be.
Even if he gets out or they drop the charges.
Which I think, if I was a gambling man, I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I guess it's an election year, so.
Yeah. I tried to prosecute him, but you know, these weak laws.
Damn Constitution got in the way.
That's right. That sounds like a Dirty Harry type quote.
I prosecute him. But the Constitution always stands between me and them.
Well, this episode, we teased a little bit about the topic. There was a Sawbones episode about DNA and paternity testing, and it was actually a really good episode, and if you haven't listened to it, you should listen to it. It's a great podcast with 2 of my favorite people in it.
Yeah, one of them is my firstborn daughter.
That's right.
And the other's my first stepson. No, not stepson, son-in-law.
There you go.
I forgot what he was.
What are you, Justin?
Well, we have to determine paternity.
That's true. One of the interesting things they talked about at the very beginning, and I'm not going to go into as much detail as they did because I'm not as eloquent on the subject, but a lot of the terminology and the pronouns and whatnot all refer to men and women and male and female when we're talking about paternity and DNA and things like that.
Especially historically.
Historically, yeah. And that's how all the laws are pretty much written for the most part, unless there's some sort of special law that's been drafted. So, yeah, we're going to be using those terms and discussing just
they're
that
not our words. We're just reading the information. So please don't let us offend you if we say something you don't think is gender worthy.
But one of the interesting things is that listening to that episode, they talked about a few things in historically that I actually was not aware of.
Well, most of them they talked about, I was not aware of.
One of the things I thought was kind of interesting was the French system, where basically unmarried fathers had no legal responsibility for children. And basically, the first French Civil Code of 1804 essentially forbid imposing any kind of legal paternity upon a man outside his voluntary consent to legal marriage. So if there was a child born out of marriage, then basically you could not force legal responsibility on that man, which to me is just crazy. And basically the way it worked is that paternity choice, the legal freedom to choose fatherhood, was gone in France because of the French Revolution. So before the Revolution, an unmarried woman had a position. It was kind of a privileged position, really. She could name the father of her child during childbirth, which is kind of interesting.
Huh.
And they said that the pain, this is the theory, the pain of childbirth, like the pain of torture, was falsely held to guarantee truthful speaking. So if you're going through that much pain of childbirth, then you must be telling the truth. And the woman's legal privilege in established paternity was summarized in the legal maximum, and I'm probably going to butcher this, creditor virgini paternity, believe the young woman giving birth.
That's the rule of the land, believe the young woman giving birth.
Yeah, but that was the rule in pre-Revolutionary War France, that basically the woman had the right to name who the father was, and then the father had a legal responsibility to take care of that child. And a lot of these things...
Did they make her yell it out right at the point of giving birth, right when the head pops out, then they say, who was the father? It was Jimbo. They probably didn't have any Jimbos in France, did they?
Jimbo the Frenchman?
No. Yeah.
I don't think so.
They probably didn't even have French fries there.
Pierre, that's more of a French name.
Pierre done it.
I think the technical term you're looking for was when the head crowns as well. We can check with Sydney on that one.
The head crowns?
Yeah.
Not popping out?
Yeah, I don't think.
There's no popping going on.
And by the way, I do not believe that's the preferred nomenclature. So basically, if the man did not want to have legal status of the father of the child, he basically had to make arguments to civil officials to try to overturn the assertion of the mother that said that during childbirth. And usually, you would not win doing that. And once we had basically the French Revolution, at that point, they said, you know what, this is a constraint on liberty and freedom, and we don't want to have that. So basically, we're going to do away with that, and that's what they did.
A constraint on liberty and freedom for men.
Yeah. So basically, women had the kind of upper hand, essentially, pre-Revolution, and after Revolution, the men did. Which, I got to say, if we're talking about progress, that seems kind of counterintuitive to me. It seems like kind of a backwards situation. Like, maybe you always think of the French Revolution as being going forward and a good thing. That seems kind of backwards.
Well, maybe the way you look at it is, up until the French Revolution, everything was run by the aristocracy.
Yeah.
And they knew what they were doing, or they had the money to make it be whatever they wanted it to be. But maybe the common man was the one dealing with this problem because of that, and the common man overruled him when they overthrew him in the Revolution.
That could be so true. That
might have been where it came from, was the grassroots movement.
But I will say, it does seem kind of counterintuitive to me, because essentially you don't want these children to become a ward of the state that we all have to take care of. So it seems to me you would really want somebody on there to kind of take responsibility and foot the bill.
Well, now, I will say this. In the research that I found, it said that what it said about that is, you know, that it's not that paternity suits weren't allowed. It's just that they were basically null and void because the man had to either verbally or in writing accept that the child was his, was the main proof.
You're talking about in France?
Yeah, in France at that time. So if he did, then it was his. If he didn't, then you couldn't prove it. So there was no sense having a paternity suit, because if he didn't admit it, then it wasn't. But the reason was, the reason they wrote this is that the government did not want to reduce the natural or acknowledged children or the mother's legacy or finances. So that's what they felt like. Well, you've got this illegitimate child out here, and they're going to detract from the actual children, the acknowledged children, and the mother. They're going to lose money because of this other. So what they did impose is there was what basically food money. The guy, the dad, the supposed dad, would have to pay enough to feed the child, but the child then would have no claim to an inheritance or anything.
So it's almost like he had to pay child support, but that's it.
Yeah, it had no claim. That was mostly what it was, to protect the people that were within the realm legitimately from having to lose out because of this.
Well, that makes
whether that's right or not, I don't know. I mean, but that was their reasoning for it.
Well, that makes a bit more sense then, because I don't understand why you would want to have these kids who aren't being supported by somebody out there.
Yeah,
I mean, it wouldn't make any sense.
Well, that's what it says, that you would have to, he would have to supply the cost of food. Now, I don't know how you determine the cost of food. You know, that's a big boy there. Your bill's a lot higher than the one that has that little illegitimate girl. he eats three sacks of groceries a day.
Little baby, little Jimbo over there, he eats three eggs a day.
Little Jimbo Pierre.
Yeah, Jimbo Pierre. He's eating us out of house, home, and baguettes.
Marie, baguettes!
Well, that makes a little bit more sense. Now, one of the other things I thought that was kind of interesting that they touched on in the Sawbones episode, and they had a couple of different names for it, and Justin was cracking up when he was talking about it, were the erection courts.
Yeah, the erection court, the impotence court.
The impotence courts. I'd never heard of this.
Sexual wars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the research I did about this, a lot of it popped up with regard to...
Popped up? Was that...
I can't help it.
You can't help it? Yeah, there's pill for that.
And a lot of this really came into play. It had to do with divorces and things like that. And what they would do is they would try to get the marriage annulled based on the fact that there was some sort of sexual problem. Because at that time, it was basically viewed that each spouse was required to have sex with the other spouse. That was part of their marital duty. And if you couldn't perform and couldn't do that,
marital duty,
then you were basically breaching your responsibilities, and that was grounds for an annulment. And you could actually file this and go to court and, like you said, have a trial by impotence.
Not a trial by battle. What is that? The trial by battle that we covered before?
Yeah. Choose your weapon.
That's the problem. He doesn't have one.
Now, these were ecclesiastical courts, so these were basically kind of more like church courts. They weren't your, I guess, courts that we would think of today through the government. But at that time, the church and the government were kind of part and parcel as well, so maybe a bit of a blurred line there. But so when it first started happening in the 14th century, there was a tidal wave of accusations, according to one article I read. And what would happen is that basically, generally, the wife... And this happened quite a bit with the aristocracy. It was responsible, I think, for one-fifth of all... The aristocracy was responsible for one-fifth of all these kinds of trials like this, even though they really only represented like 2% of the population. So it was a very disparate number.
Well, part of the reason for that is it cost money.
It did.
To go to this court, you had to get a lawyer, and you had to pay court costs and all this other kind of stuff. So only the rich people could afford to go there, and they were so well covered because... You know, it's just like now, whenever you see some famous person that something bad happens to them, everybody wants to read about it and send all the gossip rags and everything else. Same thing then. Oh, look, there's this aristocratic person dragged into the impotence court. We got to see about this.
Yeah, it became quite the spectacle.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing, too, about these is that the prevailing party actually got their attorney's fees. So the other side would have to pay for the attorney's fees. And if it was annulled, if the man received some sort of dowry from marrying... then he had to return the dowry as well. Right. So there was a lot riding on this.
Yeah.
So the generally the wife would make an accusation saying that the husband was unable to perform and therefore was breaching their marital responsibilities.
The guy could never claim that she was unable to perform, maybe just unwilling.
So I think it could go the other way. I just don't know how that would work.
What are you going to prove?
I don't know. So basically, the wife would make an accusation, and then they would actually have to have a trial by Congress, was the technical term for it. Congress meaning, like, basically the fourth meaning according to the dictionary on Google, which stands for coming together, like sexually. So,
you mean mutual orgasm?
No. I don't think that happened.
Oh. Well, you said coming together.
That's a myth.
Oh.
No, I'm just kidding.
Speak for yourself.
So, anyway, what would happen is basically they would have, like, a jury. There would be different priests, clergymen, surgeons, midwives, people like that. And they would actually have to perform sexually in front of these people to show that they actually could perform. And so the one quote that I'd read about one of the guys who had this trial, I guess they had maybe a preliminary hearing of some sort where they examined him, and they said that he was basically able to get an erection, and it looked like his 10 fingers had been putting in lots of work for many years. I thought that was a very funny description.
Yeah, but that's what it was. It was a two-part test. The first one was just seeing if he could get an erection. Then the second part was, could he finish the deed?
Right. And so the he actually had the trial by Congress, and he couldn't. And so he passed the first part, but not the second part. The interesting thing about this is they did all kinds of different things. They would basically strip the man and the woman naked and make sure they didn't have anything on them, like any kind of other fluids or blood or anything like that,
right,
to make sure that they didn't make a claim that they had had sex and these fluids were the result of it,
right? Yeah. They said a lot of times guys would try to trick them by bringing in a vial of blood to show that he had penetrated her maidenhead.
So they stripped him down, made sure they didn't have anything, and then
I just had to guess at what that was. I didn't really want to know.
Yeah, and then they would sit there behind sheets and kind of watch them and say, "Okay, you have 2 hours."
Yeah, they would put up sheets, and I'd be out of it, peek through them.
Yeah, which sounds horrible.
It sounds very horrible. I mean, it sounds like the first porno flick ever made, or something like that. You know?
Yeah, it absolutely does. I think you'd have to be a certain kind of person to be able to perform in a situation like that.
I think Harry Reams was in it.
Harry Reams.
Yeah.
Who's he?
He's one of the very first porn stars I remember hearing of.
Oh.
So I figure he must have been there then.
He's before my time. It's a good porn star name, though.
Yeah. He's the one that started that, all that about the porn star mustache, too, because he had that porn star mustache.
But I think a lot of these different trial by impotence, they probably had a lot to do with ED.
Well, yeah, they didn't have the little blue pill back in those days.
No, economic decisions.
Oh.
Because they probably thought that maybe financially the wedding, the marriage wasn't working out, so they wanted to try to get out of it.
Yeah, or they've been offered a better deal by some other nobleman or something.
Yeah, so you get a high-priced lawyer, you go in there, you win, you get the lawyer's fees paid for by the losing side, and you get your dowry back. That's an ED if I've ever heard of one.
Yeah, but you can't get your maidenhead back, though.
Probably not. I don't think there's a pill for that.
I read one article about it. It said in the dreaded standing up in court. What's the name of the article? And it talks about the dreaded French impotence trials. Performance anxiety took on a whole new meaning. And it said a husband's inability to perform was one of the few reasons that the church would allow a marriage to be annulled. So disgruntled women who could afford the legal costs would regularly charge their husbands with injurious non-consummation. So this legal tradition dated back to the 1300s. It said the onus was placed on the husband to demonstrate his powers of erection before an expert team of priests, surgeons, and midwives. These learned observers would carefully examine his equipment to reach an opinion on its elastic tension and natural motion before demanding proof of ejaculation. Many men found that their powers would fade on first examination. "Just looking at you makes me shrivel," one humiliated husband moaned to his tormentors. But, I mean, you know, if it's a bunch of guys and they're looking at my junk, there's nothing going to happen there, you know? And these midwives, it depends, you know, are these young midwives or these older midwives? Because if I've got three old crones there, hand it over, slap her hair, buddy. You know, I'm going to fail this course. I'm going to fail this test. But any man who failed the test had only one recourse to avoid becoming a laughingstock. He could demand trial by Congress, which is just what you were talking about. As recounted by a string of contemporary accounts, this astonishing piece of legal pornography would take place in a neutral territory agreed upon by both parties. The married couple was examined by the court to make sure they were not concealing any devices and then ordered to the conjugal bed. The male surgeons and priest repaired behind a partition to enjoy discreet observation, while the female midwives perched by the pillows watching every move like hawks. So they were right there. Like a wrestling referee is what I'm picturing. Yeah. He's going, nope, he doesn't have her pinned yet.
One, two,
three. We got a winner. They watch it like a hawk. With a husband and wife long estranged, the wrestling beneath the sheets was far from amiable. There was bickering and harsh words, with one wife crying that her husband had put his finger therein to dilate and open her by such means alone. One critic of the trials noted that it would take only a marvelous, determined man, and even brutish, not to turn flaccid. After 1 or 2 hours, the experts approached the battle scenes with candles to establish whether or not there had been penetration and suitable emissions. One defeated husband, a certain Monsieur Debray, although his member had been declared by the doctors big, stiff, red, and long, and placed it in good order, he lost his case as he had only scattered aqueous seed upon the mattress. It said that the women who had funds to start impotent trials were almost all from the aristocracy, so it is not surprising that each new charge provoked a salacious scandal that was disseminated by Parisian pamphleteers. So that's, I guess, like the newspapers that they were handing right out. It said that there was, by the mid-17th century, a carnival atmosphere was attending these trials, as shown by the case of a handsome young nobleman, René de Cordouan, the Marquis de Langy, recorded in detail by the contemporary chronicler of Parisian life, Talamant de Rogue. Accused of impotence by his wife of 4 years in 1657, the Marquis appeared to have an open and shut case when the first examination suggested that his wife was not a virgin. But there was lingering doubt and innuendo, so the Marquis decided to restore his sullied reputation through trial by Congress. In Paris, bets were laid on the outcome of the trial, and dirty songs were composed. Society ladies flirted with the Marquis, with a certain Madame Delaune declaring openly, "I would so like to be condemned to trial by Congress with him." When the feuding couple appeared at the site, a luxurious bathhouse, servants had to force a path through the crowd of curiosity seekers. The mob's sympathy was squarely with the dashing Delangy, who was thought to have been falsely accused by a harridan. The wife was loudly booed, while the Marquis strutted arrogantly before his admirers, for all the world as if he was already in. As he slipped beneath the sheets with his wife, Delangy jauntily yelled to the doctors, "Bring me 2 fresh eggs, that I may get her a son at the first shot." But disaster struck. The Marquis was heard by the doctors to be grunting, cursing, and finally praying. After 2 hours, Delangy gave up, crying, "I am ruined."
I read about him as well. He's the one that after this, his reputation was really bad, right? Because of what took place. And so he moved to the country where he wasn't supposed to marry again, but he did marry. And then his wife had 7 more children.
7 children, yeah. So, that was his retribution.
And so one of the people supposedly said to him that was not proof of his virility.
It was hers.
That was hers. those aren't necessarily your kids. Which I thought that was really funny.
Yeah, he thought he was all proud of it, and then come to find out, everybody else was saying, "Oh yeah, we know what's going on there."
Yeah. So, but there's some more interesting stuff that we're going to talk about. Before that, I think we have a pending motion before the court.
Why, yes, if it please your impotent courtship, sir, I would like to approach the bench for things coming up.
Denied. I'm not sure, but I think that was you just called me impotent.
No, I said you were running the court.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to bring some things up.
Oh, okay. Who do we have?
We have our good friends at BetterHelp.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, such as impotence?
BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 24 hours.
It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online.
There is a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's counselor network, which may not be locally available in many areas.
Here in West Virginia, it can be hard to find a specialized counselor, especially in the rural areas.
Absolutely.
The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor.
You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room.
Reading old magazines.
Real old ones. They might be all the way back to impotence court.
They could be Parisian pamphlets.
That's right. Pamphlets.
BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed.
It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available.
Visit BetterHelp.com/court and join the over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional.
So for court-appointed listeners, get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/court. Mike and Tom say, fix your peace of mind. You can't have my peace of mind. I need all I got.
Now, one of the interesting things when you're talking about paternity is presumptions. And there are certain presumptions that take place. Now, one of which is that basically if you properly address a piece of mail and stick it into the U.S. mail system, that it will be delivered. That's a presumption. Now, that's called a rebuttable presumption because you can show that it didn't happen.
Well, I don't have that presumption anymore. Our mail service at my business has been so lousy, I had to tweet at the U.S. Post Office.
You tweeted at them?
Yeah, I tweeted at them.
Did they respond?
No, I don't have enough followers for them to respond, I guess.
You should have gotten Justin on that.
I know, but I didn't want to bug him. But
hey, Justin, will you tweet at the post office for me?
I tweeted at him. I said, this is Wednesday. I haven't had any mail service since last Thursday. Did you guys close up shop and forget to tell us?
Burn.
Well, what was bad, we finally did get, the guy finally did come in Wednesday afternoon. And we said, well, where's our usual? It's usually a lady that we have.
Yeah.
We said, well, where is she? And said, well, she got promoted to a supervisor role. We said, oh, so are you the new postman? No. Well, who is? Well, nobody. What do you mean nobody? Well, they just said, we'll get to it when we can. So, you know, I wouldn't expect my mail every day. I was like, that's it? That's the best you got? And he goes, yeah, one other guy, when I told him, he cussed at me. I was like, well, we would like to. That's terrible.
That is horrible.
That's your tax dollars at work, folks.
Well, that presumption, that's one of the classic ones you learn while you're in law school, but in real life, I have come to experience that it's actually not necessarily true.
I'm going to take the post office to impotent court because I think that they're impotent. The whole post office.
They don't deliver.
No, they don't. They're not coming.
One of the other presumptions that is rebuttable as well is that if you are married, then the husband is presumed to be the biological father of the child. So again, that's a rebuttable presumption, but that's just basically one of our traditions under common law.
Yeah, and you know that joke that you always say, hey, you look like the mailman?
Yeah.
Well, see, but now you don't have to worry about that because the mailman doesn't come.
So this is probably the oldest presumption of paternity, is, like I said, this marital presumption. And basically, the marital relationship of the child's parents establishes that paternity rather than any kind of biological relationship between the child and the father. So this is before DNA testing and things like that. This was essentially what they had to base it on and want to make sure that the child was taken care of. Now, even though in this day and age with DNA testing and whatnot, that it's kind of an outdated way of thinking, it is still basically the presumption in most states. Most states have different kinds of laws which say that basically if you are married and you have a child, that father is the husband is presumed to be the father of that child. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we have amazing scientific technology now to do this kind of stuff, but that's still one of those rebuttable presumptions. You'd have to go into court and prove why you think you would ask the court to do that DNA testing to show it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thought process also is back in the day as to why this took place was because there were public policy goals to try to make sure financial support for children was there, like I had said, and keeping traditional family units intact, and shielding children from kind of being stigmatized as illegitimate. So basically, no harm, no foul kind of thing. what does it matter? So the other thing that whenever you have somebody who's not married, when you're trying to look at and establish paternity before DNA testing, was they tried to look at proximity and timing. You know, could this person have possibly been the father? Were they around when the child was conceived? Things like that. You know, were they on some sort of expedition in Africa during the time? You know, can we prove that it's not possible? And if so, then that's basically one good way to avoid that kind of paternity type issue.
Yeah, if I wasn't there.
Yeah,
it's not me.
That's called the Shaggy defense.
The Shaggy defense.
It wasn't me.
It wasn't me.
Yeah.
Ooby-oo. That Shaggy?
Wrong Shaggy.
The one from Scooby-Doo?
Now, one of the interesting things we have... One of the interesting things we have here in the United States, and just as a disclaimer, I do a good bit of kind of family law that has a lot of different kind of paternity issues that pops up, and one of which...
You're doing a lot of popping up in this episode.
It's my favorite phrase. Especially like with an abuse and neglect court with like child protective services, things like that. And there are a lot of paternity issues that happen in those kinds of cases. Natural result of those kinds of cases, I guess, is all you can say. So there is quite a bit of paternity testing that goes on in the court system.
Hmm.
It's not something that's pretty much rare. I mean, it happens daily. So,
wow.
Now, another way of establishing paternity is what's called a birth certificate.
So most people put their names on it?
Exactly. I'm sure you're aware of a birth certificate.
I am. You have to have one to get a driver's license.
That's right. And so basically, if the father signs their name on a birth certificate, then they are legally the father. And that's something that would have to be overturned by a court as well. And I had one case in particular I thought was kind of interesting. The mother gave birth, and either she didn't know who the father was because it was a couple different possible candidates, or...
That sounds like our show we're fixing to have.
Mama Mia,
yeah.
Or alternatively, you know, she didn't alert the guy after whatever. But anyway, there was no father there to sign the birth certificate, so it was basically just blank. Okay. So there's only a mom. So a couple years later, she marries this guy. Didn't know the guy at the time when she gave birth. And what he did is he signed an affidavit acknowledging paternity of the child, saying, oh, you know what? I am the father of this child. And they amended the birth certificate, and it was kind of like a DIY type adoption.
Mm-hmm.
Because that space was blank, actually.
So fill in the blank, and he automatically becomes the father.
Yeah, but here's
without going through adoption.
But here's the thing, is that later on, they got divorced. And so he had to pay child support.
Oh, yeah.
And he couldn't turn around and say, like, well, you know.
Right. Wasn't really buying.
Yeah.
Because he was on the birth certificate by his own... By his own willingness.
Yeah. So I thought that was kind of a very interesting situation with regards to that. And you have things like that that pop up from time to time.
Pop up?
Again. It's just in the back of my mind.
You got that on the brain.
I do, I guess so.
But, you know, you don't go into marriage planning the divorce, so, you know,
no.
You do those kind of things.
Unless you have a prenup.
Right. Then you do plan on it.
then you've laid it out. You've planned it well.
That's right.
One of the things that Sydney mentioned when she was talking about DNA testing on the Sawbones episode was that they had, in Brazil, they had done some DNA testing on some twin brothers, and basically the court ordered both of them to pay child support, because with the DNA testing, you can't differentiate between the twins.
Right.
So there was no way to determine which of these twins was actually the father. So the Brazilian court ordered both of them to pay child support.
Well, I tell you what, if I was the one that wasn't responsible, I would be pissed at my brother.
Well, I had to try to research this story a little bit more because I figured there's a bit more to it, and I got some more facts. So the twin brothers in Brazil, they're both being forced to pay child support. They refused to admit who the father of the baby girl was in an attempt to making support payments. So they were both trying to say, point the finger at the other one.
One was helping the other one out.
Yeah. And so they did additional DNA testing, and it was inconclusive. The judge basically said, I'm going to hold you both accountable for child support.
Right.
And the brothers, and it says, whose identities remain anonymous, have been using their physical similarities to trick women into thinking they were the other person. So they've been playing this twin game for a while.
Oh, so the judge called them on it.
Yeah, they'd use each other's names either to attract as many women as possible or hide betrayal in their relationships. The judge wrote this in a statement.
Mm-hmm.
And they're each required to pay $60 a month to the girl's mother, which is double the amount normal for a child from the economic background in that situation.
Wow.
And the judge said, basically, one of them is acting in bad faith in order to hide the fact that he is the father. Such vile behavior cannot be tolerated by the law. And the judge
said, good for him.
Yeah, the judge said the brother's clumsiness should not prevent the young girl from her right to a good life and called it a major deciding factor in his decision. And the mother basically said when she testified, that she, believing she was with one man, but started to question things when the man would show up driving a different vehicle. So it's like she'd see one guy, then turn around, and there's the other guy in a different car.
Boy, he's fast.
And basically, she said, they know the truth, but they're trying to take advantage of their similarity to evade any responsibility.
Right.
So
he nailed him.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
You know, we read, I don't know what our topic was, but we did a topic where there was a case where the lady gave birth to twins, and one was Caucasian and one was African American.
Yeah.
And she had actually had sex with two different men within a very close time period, and two separate eggs had been fertilized, and they both grew and were born at the same time.
Yeah.
And imagine the shock when you deliver that. What in the world? I mean, what are the odds of something like that?
Well, then you go to do DNA testing, and the DNA testing supports just that.
Yeah, there's two completely different ones. They're not genetically not the sisters, you know.
I mean, that was the perfect storm of DNA weird family court type situations.
Yeah.
Now, one interesting thing, and we talked about it a little bit at the beginning, is the law is very slow to evolve and change. And that means that basically the law hasn't kept pace with different family dynamics and different structures we have today. So basically, as we said, state paternity laws often use gender-specific language like mother, father, male, female, things like that. And what it does is it creates kind of a weird confusion for same-sex couples because it's unclear whether or not there's a like kind of a marital presumption or paternity applies to them because you're using these pronouns and it makes it kind of hard to understand what's going on. And basically, one of the interesting decisions was in Arizona recently, and two appellate courts had conflicting decisions. And so basically, the Arizona Supreme Court addressed it in this case. And the facts of the case are that a lesbian couple had a child through artificial insemination during their marriage. And I guess only one of the women had a biological connection to the child. That must have been her egg, and they used a sperm donor or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
The couple held themselves out as the child's parents and entered into like kind of a co-parenting agreement. And then when they later separated, the biological mother of the child basically wanted to terminate the non-biological mother's right to contact with the child and was trying to use basically the law as it was written as saying that, hey, you know, you don't have a right. You're the non-biological parent.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the Arizona Supreme Court held that the non-biological mother was entitled to the marital presumption of paternity despite Arizona's use of gender-specific language in its paternity statute. And the Supreme Court said, the marital paternity presumption is a benefit of marriage, and the state cannot deny same-sex spouses the same benefits afforded opposite-sex spouses.
Hmm.
So whether or not it's a biological or not, that marital presumption actually made sure that this one woman had rights to her non-biological child. So it was kind of an interesting case.
Well, we had one here locally that was even more, had one more twist and turn than that. And that was the lady, the biological mother,
mm-hmm.
had the baby through a sperm donor,
mm-hmm.
and the sperm donor signed papers saying, I've got no responsibility here. I'm just donating sperm to somebody that she knew. And they signed those papers, and her partner, they got married and had two children that in the same manner. Used the same guy both times. So then later, they divorced. Well, then she remarried and was living with the other with her new partner,
mm-hmm.
with her new spouse, and then she got cancer and died. The biological father, who was only a donor at that point, stepped in and said, I'd like to have custody of the kids. And since the second one wasn't even the original one, you know, when she first had the children, the biological father, who had basically signed away all the rights, was given the rights to the children.
Really?
Yeah. And they were out of state and everything, so they had to move and go where he was.
I never heard that case before.
Yeah.
Was it, I guess it wasn't in the news and things like that. It was just maybe.
No, it wasn't in the news. We just happened to know the family.
Right. So basically that could have been appealed possibly and maybe gotten a different result or something along those lines.
Yeah. It was probably, I don't know this to be a fact, but it's probably more of a matter of money. I mean, you just have to keep going back to court and filing and, you know, appealing, and these things aren't easy and they drag out. And then you've got to consider kids having to come in and testify and stuff like that. So it just makes it hard on everybody. And at some point you have to say who's this helping and who's it hurting?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the polar star for any family law matter involving children is supposed to always be the best interest of the child. Mm-hmm. That's what you always go back to. If you're ever arguing anything in family court about children, you can make your full argument and then you always end up, and it's in the best interest of the child to do what I said.
Mm-hmm.
So the Minnesota Supreme Court had a very kind of similar issue to the Arizona Supreme Court that I mentioned. And Minnesota's paternity statute says that a child born during marriage is presumed to be the child of the biological mother's husband. Basically, without more, the statute's use of gender-specific language makes it unclear whether the presumption applies to same-sex couples, because it's very gender-specific type language.
Mm-hmm.
And to remedy the issue, Minnesota enacted a separate statute requiring courts to use gender-neutral language when enforcing the rights of same-sex couples, including in cases involving parentage presumptions based on civil marriage. So, under Minnesota law, the marital presumption of paternity should apply to a child born to a same-sex couple. So, Minnesota was trying to be proactive in that and address the gender specific language like that. So, and I think that,
well, it's just because you legally couldn't get married to a same sex partner up until recent times.
Right.
So that's why the language is outdated. But I don't know if people thought about that at the time, that they need to go in and update all that language, or if they didn't know or they didn't care. I don't know.
Well, I think it's common sense to think that basically if a same sex couple has a child together,
that shouldn't matter the language, it would just apply.
Right.
Yeah.
But then you have people who end up separating and want to argue and mm-hmm. split hairs, and then you have lawyers basically arguing over the specific language that's in there.
If you're a lawyer and you've got specific language that works in your favor, you're going to use it. Whether you believe what its intent was or not, you're going to use that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, if I was presented that case and the law said this one thing, it was very specific.
Gender-specific,
yeah,
then you'd use that to your advantage. That's just the way it's going to work.
Yeah, but I do think that the our lawmakers need to update all that because we're in a different time. But laws, unfortunately, take forever to get changed. Mm-hmm. So
this is true. Well, one of the things I found, you talk about the paternity laws being changed. They mentioned it on Sydney and Justin's on Sawbones about Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
In his paternity suit. Said that he was, in 1943, Chaplin became embroiled in an adults-only legal drama when his alleged former paramour slapped him with a paternity suit, a case that would change the future of family law in America. All right, he was married at the time to his third wife, Paulette Goddard, and he met a promising young actress named Joan Barry. He contracted her for a potential film called Shadows and Substance, and according to FBI documents, the two became lovers shortly after their first meeting.
I heard she was very promising.
Very promising. Yes, she was promising something. In October 1942, Chaplin invited Barry, who was in Los Angeles, to meet him in Manhattan, and he purchased her a train ticket. FBI reports state that while in New York, Barry attended various parties with Chaplin, and it is alleged that he made her available to other individuals for immoral purposes, .. The latter was a violation of the Mann Act, a.k.a.
yes,
the White Slave Traffic Act, which states that a person cannot cross state lines to engage in prostitution or immoral behavior. 2 months later, back in Los Angeles, the unstable Barry, who was later arrested for vagrancy, broke into Chaplin's house where she brandished a gun. She also claimed that the two were intimate at the time. In court, Barry testified that the two engaged in four acts of sexual intercourse at or about the date when in ordinary course of nature, the child must have been begotten. These acts, and she gave the dates, October 10th, 23rd, 24th, and 30th. So, or that was in December of 1942. In October 1943, Barry gave birth to a daughter. So it said Barry not only accused him of violating the Mann Act, a charge on which he was indicted and then exonerated, but took him to court to prove that he indeed was the father of the child. Between 1944 and 45, Chaplin-Barry scandal unfolded in court. By then, Chaplin was married to his fourth and final wife, Oona O'Neill. The couple would have eight children together and remain married for more than three decades until Chaplin's passing in 1977. Back then, there was only one method of determining paternity of a child, a blood test. So blood was drawn from Chaplin, Barry, and baby Carol Ann. The doctors weighed in on the results, with each one coming to the same conclusion. Chaplin was not the child's father, which prompted Barry's own lawyer to state that three distinguished medical men, preeminent in their fields, have decided that Mr. Chaplin is eliminated. We must and do abide by their conclusions. But Barry wasn't done. Prior to the testing, Barry had signed an agreement with Chaplin saying that if the test concluded he was not Carol Ann's father, she would dismiss the charges. But when the paternity findings weren't in her favor, she changed her mind and pursued Chaplin further. So anyway, the whole point of it was they ended up that they decided that one court, they went to trial, one ended up being a hung jury, they did another one, and they found him guilty 11-1 of being the father. But they changed the law after that to where the blood test was admissible. So even though they had the blood test, it wasn't admissible in court.
Right.
You couldn't do that. Now, you know, it's like if they were both, or if it was some type of a blood type that the baby was, that he couldn't have been the father, then it should have eliminated him, you know?
Right.
But obviously that wasn't the case. So, but they said that, anyway, the blood test became the chief evidence in determining paternity after the Chaplin case.
Well, it could be one of those instances, too, where this was kind of a newer science or a newer technology that basically wasn't readily accepted by the courts at that point.
Yeah.
But after that, you know, it probably was.
But it was kind of the same thing as when you did the one on, what was it, Fatty Arbuckle?
Yeah.
How his, even though he ended up being acquitted, that his career was kind of ruined after that. Same thing happened to Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
That after that, all that dragged out and all that salacious, there again, it's a famous person, and they did something wrong, and everybody wants to read about it, see about it, and his career just never went anywhere after that.
Do you know who else was somebody famous who was prosecuted under the Mann Act? I think we talked about this before, maybe.
I think it sounds familiar, but I don't remember.
It was Jack Johnson.
Jack Johnson?
The boxer.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, so basically he had crossed state lines with a woman who was, I guess, his paramour. And he, because of racial tensions and things like that, they wanted to use that to kind of prosecute him for that. And so right. He was. So,
yeah.
Yeah, but whenever I hear the Mann Act, that's what I always think of.
You the man. Now act.
It's not exactly what it means. Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Breeze.
So Legal Breeze is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal questions about different topics we discussed today. So the first term I have is a general one. It's called presumption. What is a presumption?
Well, presumption means that if this, then that. Like if your name is on the birth certificate, then you are presumed to be the father. Or if you're married to the wife and you have a baby after a certain amount of time, then you're presumed to be the father.
Now, that's a special kind of presumption. You remember what I said?
Rebuttable presumption.
That's right. It's a rebuttable presumption because it's presumed, but it's not written in stone.
It's not guaranteed.
Yeah. So you can attack it, although it's hard to attack a presumption.
It's rebuttable.
That's right.
That's what happens if you get your butt cut off. You get another one put on and you're rebuttable.
What does the phrase creditor virgini patruenti mean?
That means that you have not completed, you haven't consummated your marriage.
No. It translates to meaning believe the young woman giving birth.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So that's the phrase that whenever... When
she'd scream out, Jimbo! Jimbo did it!
Jimbo Pierre.
Jimbo Pierre did it. That means Jimbo Pierre's the dad.
That was how the paternity was...
When the head's popping out.
Yeah, crowned. popped out or popped up is the phrase that pays this podcast, this episode. So, but yeah, that was in pre-Revolutionary War France, where the woman was able to establish paternity of a non-married father. So, okay, here we talked a little bit about testing paternity and things like that. And one of the main things we talked about was DNA.
Right.
What does DNA stand for?
Antibiotics.
Deoxyribonucleic acid.
Yeah, that thing.
Yes. That was kind of a cheap
you
shot.
You didn't go over that.
That was a cheap shot. Well, you're throwing around DNA like you know what it means.
Well, I don't throw it around because you might end up with a paternity suit. You know, one thing I did come across, I thought it was just the French courts that had the impotence courts, but they had them in England as well. And this was back in the 14th century in York. And this was erectile dysfunction in the Middle Ages. And they called it privates on parade. And they talked about several cases that were in there, but this one really stuck out to me. It said, in English cases, a court would call upon a number of honest women to perform a physical examination of the alleged erectile dysfunction. For example, in the case between Tedia Lambert and John Sanderson, which dates from 1370, three women were charged with doing a physical examination of John and reported back to the court. They reported that the member of the said John is like an empty intestine of mottled skin, and it does not have any flesh in it, nor veins in the skin, and the middle of its front is totally black. And said witness stroked it with her hands and put it in semen, and having this been stroked and put in that place, it neither expanded nor grew. Asked if he has a scrotum with testicles, she says that he has the skin of a scrotum, but the testicles do not hang in the scrotum, but are connected with the skin, as is the case among young infants. Within a few days of this testimony, the court annulled the marriage. Could you imagine going down in history with that description of your junk?
Well, there's a case in somebody showed me one time, and it was a man was accused of statutory rape, an elderly man. And basically his defense was it couldn't have been me because I'm impotent. I can't do it. And so they had a doctor give a description, and it described his penis as rag-like, that served no other purpose but to connect his bladder to the outside world. I'll never forget that. It serves no other purpose but to connect his bladder to the outside world.
Did you ever see the old movie Body Heat?
I think I probably did it at some point. Is that Kathleen Turner? And
yeah, there's some line in there. I can't remember it exactly, but the young niece had walked in on them. They're talking about it. They don't show this, but they were talking about it. The young niece had walked in and caught him with her having the affair with her, and said something about the young girl wasn't sure what she saw, but she left saying that she saw a bald-headed guy with one eye.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. If you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.